All right, Bob, you've given us your selection. You're going to declare an emergency and go straight in, even though it's a tailwind. John, what are your thoughts?
Well, I got to tell you, going through this scenario setup, the whole situation just made me really, really uneasy. I'm not sure I would have even embarked on this flight at the beginning. There was a lot of red flags going on. There's an airman out that's calling for ice, only 1,000 feet above our intended cruise altitude. There's snow showers around. Temperatures aloft are all very close to zero or below zero. It was a recipe for a flight that I really wouldn't want to even take off on. There's no sense of urgency here. There's just a lot of reasons why I don't think I would have even done this. I would have erred on the cautious side. But we got there. We got to deal with it now. And I think I would opt more for, as a resolution, Bob's scenario of going straight in on 1-1, declaring an emergency, shortest distance between me and concrete. If I drop it in from 3 feet and bend the gear, I walk away with it, rather than trying to spiral down into a 2,900-foot strip that's below me. So that would be my choice, but reluctantly.
Okay. Wally, out of all these not-so-good choices, what are your indications?
I take a little different tack than Bob, but I certainly agree it's time for immediate action. We need to get this airplane on the ground quickly because we're in trouble. I would request the emergency, request the GPS approach to 11, but given those weather conditions, I'd much rather fly around the pattern and land into the wind. The airplane is heavy. We're going to have to make a fast approach. Because we're in icing conditions, I don't want to put any flaps down, so that means a no-flap landing for me. The weather at 1,504, once I get below 1,500 feet, I should stop accumulating ice. So an extra couple of minutes to fly around the pattern should not ice me up anymore. And I'm not doing low-level, low-altitude maneuvering. I can make at least a 1,000-foot traffic pattern and stay within 3 or 4 miles of the airport. I can get myself lined up very nicely on 2-9, land into the wind much slower, given the fact I'm going to have a high-speed approach. So I would do pretty much everything Bob did, except I'd take that circle. But I wouldn't really consider it a circle. I consider it a visual traffic pattern.
Okay. I guess you're really between a rock and a hard place here, but, you know, there you are. I mean, so you need to do something, and you need to do it soon. You know, the longer you delay in icing, the situation only gets worse. And there have been a lot of terrible accidents out there from pilots who have just lingered and lingered and in indecision ultimately killed them. But I think I would do pretty much what Bob and John indicated. I don't like landing with a tailwind, but with the length of the runway there, 7,000 feet gives me a pretty good margin. I'm really concerned about maneuvering an airplane that is barely hanging in the sky. You don't know how close you are to the stall margin, so you're actually a test pilot here. And in a situation like this, the least amount of maneuvering, the better. So, you know, when the landing is assured, I might judiciously add some flaps, which would help, you know, slow my speed down a little bit and make the landing distance a little bit shorter. But once again, that's all when the landing is assured, because that airplane probably is going to fall out of the sky on you at some point. I think it's a good time to transition to John's point about, you know, just how did you get yourself in this scenario? But boy, as pilots, you know, aren't we all kind of operation oriented? What can I do? I can help a buddy. Here's somebody in need, and boy, I can do it. And so we kind of throw on our armor and go charging off on our white steed because we can do that. We're pilots. But this hero glow about us can certainly get us overhead in a hurry, Bob. What do you think about that?
I think you're right on, Bob. Here's a guy that was looking for an opportunity to use his IFR rating, and he says, boy, this is a perfect opportunity to make a flight. A little bit of weather out there today, a few clouds, but I can do it. And I can really help my buddy out, as you described.
And it's so hard. You know, we can't simulate ice on our airplane, but boy, let's go back to aerodynamics 101 and look at the four forces that impact on a plane in flight. You got lift, you got drag, you got gravity, and you got thrust.
All of those affected negatively by ice, one of them.
It's a quadruple whammy. I mean, how bad can it get when you got all four of those things working against you? You know, and airplanes are inherently stable. Not with ice on them, they're not. So you really are flying a rock out there. And as you talked about in the scenario, you're at or near full power. The airplane is just hanging on, and you know it's becoming a lead sled on you in a real hurry. So,
but see, it's easy to forget, Bob, that lift is affected by the shape of the airfoil. That airplane was designed with an efficient airfoil designed to create lift. And with that ice on there, you're going to lose a little bit of lift, which is going to force you to adjust your angle of attack, which is going to create a little bit more drag, a little bit more induced drag. At the same time, you've got ice accumulating on the airframe in various areas, wheel pants, struts, in addition to the wings, and that's creating more drag yet again. Your prop accumulates a little bit of ice, and efficiency of your propeller is reduced, which means you're getting less thrust. So now we've got a situation where we've got more drag than normal and less thrust to move the airplane through the air. So you got a problem there. Lift being decreased, and of course the ice weighs something, so we're increasing the weight of the airplane. So the quadruple whammy that you're talking about, you know, really applies.
Don't forget the accumulation on the tail. Remember, the rate of accumulation is proportional to the thickness of the airfoil. And that stabilizer airfoil is a lot thinner than our wing airfoil. So if we've got a good load of ice on our wings, we've probably got more on our tail. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a good reason to be very judicious and really consider whether you want to use those flaps or not. Because if you're flying okay now, you could very well disturb the airfoil or the airflow over that tail and stall the airplane.
So absolutely.
For that reason, I would plan a no-flap landing.
Right.
And that's the reason that it's driving me into the wind, just to have mm-hmm. a little more margin there.
Absolutely, Wally. The angle of relative wind that that tailplane sees changes when the flaps come down. Mm-hmm. And that might force you into a tailplane stall.
Could give you a surprise.
Yeah, it could give you a real surprise.
One of the elements that always befuddles me when I hear scenarios like this, or I talk to pilots, and boy, you talk to a lot of pilots that have been in an event similar to this. They got in over their heads, and it was like the scariest moment they ever had. But other than freezing rain, ice doesn't happen just like that. It slowly accumulates. So why aren't we, as pilots, more proactive? Why aren't we sensitive to where ice appears on our airplane and, you know, being proactive rather than reactive? Once the plane's loaded up with ice, if the temperature's below freezing and you're in the clouds, you know, you're in a world of hurt. So why aren't we better at identifying it at an earlier point in time when our options are more plentiful?
Well, I think we've got to remember that at night, it's the most hazardous situation because you won't really be cognizant of the ice. You won't really recognize it until you see some performance degradation. So at night, you need to have a flashlight. You need to be checking for ice. But getting back to your first point, Bob, and going over to John's point, probably shouldn't have left the ground. A unprotected airplane shouldn't be up there in the clouds in this kind of weather. And what provides the exclamation point here is that temperatures on the surface are at or below freezing. You're not going to be able to get rid of any ice that you do accumulate.
And one other thing that we, you know, you hear about on the big airplane side, which is just as applicable to little airplanes, is pilots getting burnt because they got their autopilots on. You know, so they're kind of fat, dumb, and happy flying along, and they're totally desensitized to the fact that the airplane is loading up with ice until such time as something dramatic happens. So an autopilot, you know, can really maybe correcting to the best of its ability until it runs out of the ability to cope anymore.
It'll typically keep cranking in the trim to try to hold altitude.
Until it runs out of trim and pops off.
Or until the airplane stalls, one or the other.
And there are some autopilots, the AFM prohibits operation in icing.
And for very good reasons.
Back to your question, Bob, about why don't we take action quicker. I think there's a couple of things to think about here. Obviously, this pilot believed he wasn't going to get ice or he wouldn't have gone on this mission. That was his belief based on some things. Turned out to be wrong. But he sees the ice and, you know, we've got a couple of things. These hazardous attitudes, it can't happen to me. Mm-hmm. It's going to stop any minute. You know, I've made this decision. I've got this plan. I've got this chance to show them how cool I am as an instrument pilot. And now suddenly things are changing. But it takes us a while to reverse that, to come to a belief that we've got to do something quick here. Because maybe it'll just get better on its own in a minute.
You're right. Well, those hazardous attitudes. And we do realistically have to look in the mirror and recognize those characteristics of us as human beings that might get us in trouble in an airplane.
And this is happening pretty fast to this guy all of a sudden.
It certainly is. One element that struck me in this scenario is, you know, here you are. You're jumping into somebody else's airplane, okay? And you are kind of signing for the flight. You know, you're putting your name on the instrument clearance. And this guy's a VFR pilot. You know, how well is this airplane? Sure, it's IFR equipped. But are you ready to subject yourself throw your life on the line in somebody else's airplane with instruments that may or may not be, tried and true? Might that lead us down a blind path?
You don't know that the database is up to date. You don't know that the transponder checks, static checks, VOR check. You don't even know if the VOR accuracy check was done. You're taking a lot for granted here by jumping into this situation. We don't even know if you've ever even flown this airplane, VFR, let alone IFR. Now you're going to be trying to make an approach in it.
Is the airplane in annual?
Yeah.
Where's the maintenance stand on the airplane?
Yeah.
And of course, with the weather coming in, you're going to take the time to really go through these things thoroughly and fully understanding what you got, right?
Or are you going to insult your friend by asking to see the logbooks? No, you're not going to do that.
Well, he's likely not going to have the logbooks with him.
Exactly. Yeah.
And another feature, you may or may not know all the systems on the airplane. If he has some add-ons.
Some STCs.
Some STCs. You're not familiar with where the switches are and how to control all the things. So you're pretty busy here all of a sudden.
But we as pilots, we're often asked, hey, would you fly my airplane back for me? Would you do this? And boy, do we ever stop and think about all the what-ifs associated with flying somebody else's airplane. And boy, no two airplanes are alike in general aviation. Everyone's just a little bit different. And in this case here, it could really exacerbate this situation.
If you do wind up making that hard landing from the downwind landing, are you even on his insurance?
Good point. Well, this pilot was suckered in to this situation for sure.
That rosy path will lead us there. But I think one thing that is just so overriding, those of us that have been in aviation for a while, there's just two entities on the weather side of aviation that are just so powerful. And those are thunderstorms and icing. Thunderstorms and icing can bring any airplane, any pilot out of the sky. So we better take them seriously. We better understand them. And only by respecting them and really being thoroughly knowledgeable about them, when they occur, how they occur, how we avoid them, can we prevent those situations. Because they're killers. There's no other way to say it.
Getting back to maneuvering with the ice, let's talk about that. I don't think we've adequately addressed that. If you're forced to maneuver with ice on the airplane to line up with a given runway, you need to keep your speed up. You need to limit your bank angle to an absolute minimum, as Wally said earlier. Wide turns, high speed, don't slow the airplane down. You don't really want to slow that airplane down until it's over the pavement. And minimize the use of flaps, and by minimize, don't use them.
Another little issue we haven't really talked about is this windshield. This windshield is icing over. You indicated in the scenario that the defroster is barely keeping up. That's not going to make this job any easier with limited visibility, looking out through a little hole or trying to look out the side window. So that's just another problem that we've got to handle.
And I'll tell you, the times that I've talked to people that flew an airplane similar to this, inevitably, the airplane stops flying long before the pilot anticipates it. And that airplane's going to drop out of the sky. And it might be from 3 feet, it might be from 10 feet. I think you kind of have to almost anticipate that this airplane is going to stop flying long before you would normally expect that. And that's just, I know that happens. I've talked to too many pilots, to deny that reality. Just in order to kind of pull it together, I think that John's preliminary comments about, boy, I'll tell you what, here we are, this is really a kind of a too late scenario. So we're really kind of dealing with this from a very, very adverse perspective. And you realize that, the further you are down the line like this, the less options you have. None of us really were happy with the options we have. So, if there's something we take home from this, it's deal with it earlier. Obviously, avoid it if at all possible. But timely decision-making is so essential anytime you have an icing scenario.